Welcome back to The Signature of Man, a podcast dedicated to pursuing truth in the philosophy of art and beauty. This is episode 7 of The Signature of Man podcast, and I'm your host, Miguel Benitez Jr. In this episode, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Surendra Gangadine. Dr. Gangadine has been a philosophy teacher and professor for over 50 years. He earned his BAs in literature and philosophy from Arizona State University, an MA in literature from Arizona State University, an MA in philosophy from the University of Arizona, and a PhD in natural theology. Dr. Gangadine has also written a book entitled Philosophical Foundation, A Critical Analysis of Basic Beliefs. I'd like to take a moment and remind listeners that content on this podcast should not be reproduced and or sold without my consent or the consent of the guest on this show. In this episode, Dr. Gangadine and I discussed art and beauty and why seeking a definition of art and resisting skepticism in aesthetics is still a worthy endeavor. So, Dr. Gangadine, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Well, Miguel, I'm so glad to be here with you. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the topic.
Yeah, as am I. I'm really glad I was able to get some time to be able to interview you on this topic in particular. And one of the goals of the podcast, one of the goals of the show that I mention over and over again in the various different people I interview and the different discussions we have, is moving toward greater understanding, greater knowledge in the fields of the philosophy of art and beauty. And so this is something that a lot of people have written a lot about, they talk a lot about. We kind of interact with these ideas of art and beauty often in life, but very rarely do we get kind of a firm definition of what art is, what beauty is. And those are some of the things that I'm hoping to talk to you about today. And in particular, when we're thinking about this idea of defining art, Morris White's, in his well-known article, The Role of Theory of Aesthetics, suggests that the history of aesthetics should give us pause about the possibility of defining art. Why do you think that this has been such a difficult task for philosophers?
Good question. I think it's part of difficulty that philosophy has had with other areas, related areas, and perhaps more basic areas. There's no consensus in philosophy today, in epistemology or metaphysics or ethics. And if anything, we're more fragmented today. We're more deeply into skepticism than we've ever been before. There's skeptics in the past, but our skepticism has gone further than that. For example, the skepticism of the sophists in Socrates' day and Protagoras that man is a measure of all things. So if we cannot get the more basic issues of epistemology and metaphysics and ethics, we're not going to have an easy time with aesthetics. And I should say that ethics comes out of both, well, first epistemology, how we know, and then metaphysics, what is real, what is eternal. And that covers both the question of what ultimately exists, whether God only is eternal or all is eternal. And then from that, the nature of man, and from that, the nature of the good. If good is grounded in human nature, and we're not even in agreement whether there's such things as natures of things, that's going to have a really big effect on how we do aesthetics.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I can say that I certainly see that in a lot of the literature, in a lot of the ways in which we talk about aesthetics. It's a challenge. And I know that many of my colleagues, I know that many people that are interested in this field are kind of frustrated that it doesn't gain more attention, that it's not taken as seriously. For example, I attended a seminar recently in which the big emphasis was trying to get more people to introduce aesthetics in a regular intro to philosophy course. But what you're saying makes sense to me as to why we have some of that struggle. One, I think it's an area that perhaps doesn't gain as much attention in philosophy, but in part because it does seem that you have to have certain things in place before you can meaningfully talk about aesthetics
Yes. I think aesthetics has a kind of independence in its own, but dependence in terms of assumptions and background. Now, as far as interest is concerned, I think people are more passionate about aesthetics and the concerns of aesthetics than the other areas, in the sense that if you can speak about truth, beauty, and goodness, aesthetics connect with the area of beauty. And beauty is something that gives us the most pleasure, and therefore we will be most intense about that. But it's also grounded in a way of knowing that is distinct from the ordinary process of philosophy. It's more connected with the intuition than it is with pure reason or practical reason, for that matter. A lot of philosophers have done that, as I just mentioned, pure and practical reason. I think Aristotle had an interest in it, Plato did, so did Kant. Have an interest in this area. It's almost like the cherry on top of the ice cream float or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that actually came up in the seminar that I attended. It was virtual. At the time of the recording of this podcast, we're still in lockdown over COVID. And so, but yeah, it came up that for such a large period of time in Western history, every major philosopher had something to say about aesthetics. Yes. And then it's only more recently that you have less that are saying something about aesthetics.
Well, probably because of the turn toward logical positivism 25 to 75 years ago in philosophy, and a greater skepticism in the postmodern continental philosophers. So I think if we dig, we can find things in the contemporary European philosophers, even within the postmodern attitude. But yeah, it's there, it's to be done. We need to, so to speak, recover this along with recovering a lot of other things in philosophy.
Okay, good. And so when I walk into my classroom at the beginning of the semester, one of the very first questions that I raise to the class is, what is art? We very quickly also get into conversations about what is beauty. And the kind of unquestioned assumptions for most of my students, for most people I just talk to in general, is, and we kind of know the cliches, eye is in the beauty of the beholder, you know, ideas of beauty kind of not being something that should be disputed. And when I ask the question directly, what is art? The most common response I get is, anything is art. Anything you want to be art, anything that you see as art is art. And so in a moment, I'd like for you to tell us, how do we even begin thinking about these things? But first, why is it worth doing the heavy lifting, the hard work of trying to kind of narrow down on what art is? As I mentioned, you know, Weitz isn't very hopeful that we can even do something like that. Why? Why should we pursue this?
Because there's what you might call aesthetic skepticism. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And beauty is something we're not ready to just give up on in a very deep down way. And the juxtaposition of those two things requires us to give attention, to do the heavy lifting, as you said. And it's with a certain amount of trepidation, for want of a better term, maybe humility might be a better term, that I begin to approach the question, but it's too passionate to leave alone. And I take some of my philosophy provocateur, kind of the gadfly of Socrates' gadfly, where we want to sting the horse into action or move the student to think, and you just go crazy with them, jump right into the middle of it, the fray, and start a brawl.
Right.
That's right. A good way to get going. And the way, for example, in aesthetics, I said, in epistemology, I said, tell me one thing you know. And they start telling me, and I start knocking that down and start getting angry and angry, and then we don't know anything. And it says, all right, now let's build the more.
Right.
So I go into the aesthetic factor, well aware of the great amount of subjectivity and skepticism there is there, by saying, look, Bach is better than rock any day.
Sure.
And that starts the brawl, okay?
Right.
And we go at it, and then they start getting a little bit more, and they start settling down and say, all right, well, maybe I have a point there. I do that also with the question of friendship and friendship of the good. I say, how many friends do you have? And some guy says, you know, many, many. And someone says, few. And then I go through and says, tell me, I guess you have no friends, do you? And they kind of slouch their head down. No, I don't have any friends. Yeah. They kind of yield to the reasoning going into it.
Right.
So they can be reached, should be reached, must be reached. We must reach each other.
Very good. So how do we even begin? How should we begin to think about something that's so daunting, like art?
Art and non-art and beauty. First of all, we don't want to include everything under art. Art is not the only value. It's a great value, but not the only value. Just to speak, there's truth and goodness as well. And there's beauty, that great beauty, beauty that leaves us in awe, but is not art. For example, a beautiful person, beautiful in form and in character. The word cool is sometimes used for these persons, but beauty in a person is not art. Beauty in nature is not art. Beauty in certain things we create is not art. Maybe the artisan operating, but we want to distinguish between beauty and that is very attractive, very much to be valued, and not say if it's beautiful and moves me in a certain way, then it's art. If I like it, it's art. I think we have to limit art. And one way to do that is from the examples we've already used by saying beauty per se is not art, is natural sources of beauty. For it to be called a work of art, it has to be a work of a human being. The work of God or the work of nature or whatever is not in the realm of art. It's in the realm of beauty, but not the same as art. So the first distinguishing character of art, it is by human being. Now that leaves a lot of things wide open. There are a lot of things that human beings do that is not art. It's a form of communication. I might even say it's a form of revelation. And there is self-revelation involved in the work of art, tells you something about the artist, but that's not the focus of it. Art is by human beings, and it is, of course, for human beings. I think that goes without saying. And it is, lastly, in a very particular way, about human beings. Not particular human beings, but about all human beings, about human nature, about the human condition. It's about what is universal in human beings.
Okay.
And that's the stage for the next statement about art. So we could say art is humanist in its core. It's by humans, it's for humans, and it's about humans.
Okay. And if I could just pause you there for a second, because it's interesting that you started there, because that's actually where the discussion in my classes begins. I teach humanities, and so we actually begin with ancient human civilizations, and we look at things like cave paintings, and we look at things that some might call art, and we just start to even ask the question and make the observation that it does seem that art has been with humanity as far back as humanity goes. It seems to be part of what we do as humans, but you're saying it is a human thing. Yes. I know that some have raised the question, when you look at a beaver's dam, a bird's nest, a bee's hive, or even there were some YouTube videos that went viral of elephants painting on a canvas, right? What is it that makes those things not art?
Well, part of the difficulty there is, how do you distinguish between humans and non-humans?
Okay.
If there's no essential difference, then there's going to be, and we're struggling with that in a naturalistic worldview, which says that human beings are essentially within the realm of animals. There's not an essential difference between the two, between an expression of an emotion or feeling and a concept. Or we don't necessarily distinguish between knowledge by reason, a concept, and knowledge through the senses, image. So we start missing it there in terms of our epistemology, and it goes from there. So what makes perhaps a paint on a canvas by an elephant can start approximating a Jackson Pollock painting.
Okay.
Or a John Cage musical.
Yes.
Composition. So we set up to this human and non, a beaver's dam, a beehive, the bird call. Beautiful, the sound that animals make that may be haunting, an owl or a wolf or all of that. We want to say that's nature, that's beautiful, or there's something deeply stirring in that. But in the same way we distinguish a waterfall from a painting of a waterfall, we want to say it's beautiful and maybe more beautiful in a way than the painting of it.
Right.
But art is a human act of human beings. And you drew something interestingly. Is it essential in human beings to do art? Well, I'm not sure all human beings do art, but at least some in the human community naturally, it seems to come out. Not everyone is a musician. Human beings can respond to music, they can respond to art, and some are artists. Not everything by an artist is art.
Okay. So one last follow-up on the distinction between the art that humans produce and then some of these other things that animals produce. Karl Marx, and it's always odd for me to kind of quote him in this context, but he suggests that what makes it different, and he agrees with what you've said, some of the things in nature are more beautiful than things that people make. But for him, the key difference is that whatever a human is making, the art that a human makes is first erected in the imagination, mm-hmm. and then it's brought into the concrete. Do you think he's onto something there? Is that not quite the distinction?
What we're speaking about, it's an act of human beings, whether it's first in the imagination, and the problem there is first, or whether it's simultaneous,
right.
It's not after,
right.
But sometimes it comes out in the process. It's an act of a human being. We said it's communication, and we're communicating to other human beings, and we're communicating a specific subject matter. If I wanted the garbage taken out and I said to someone, take out the garbage before noon today, that's a communication, but that's not art. I think it kind of the example, argument by example in this case, is good enough to say
yes.
Don't disagree about that.
Right.
So it's by human communicating to human beings, and might say, what is the intentionality to communicate? It's against just do something and see whether anyone ever sees it or not. I think the intentionality is to communicate, and it's about human beings, and it's not just about a particular human being that may communicate it, as in writing a biography about a particular person, but let's say someone could do a biographical account of the death of Ivan Illich in Tolstoy's story. And I don't know how close it would be to Tolstoy's story, but usually the biography would include a lot of other things that would not ordinarily be in the story. What comes out in that story is that what is being depicted is something about the human condition, not just about Ivan Illich. As a matter of fact, that leads us to the second characteristic of art. Art is in the realm of more perception than conception. It's more like sense experience and it is like reason. It's perception. And the artist is perceiving this condition of man through a particular. So the artist gets to the universal, but in a different way than the philosopher gets to the universal. The artist gets to the universal through the particular understood as symbol. I'm going to say that is an essential characteristic of art. And that's going to help us to distinguish when an artist, let's say, is writing a poem and he's really giving a narrative about a particular using artistic form like verse. Let's say Wordsworth is saying something about in his prelude, he's talking about his youth. That's a particular. I don't think we get to a universal there. So that other things in it or elsewhere in that work that may stand out as art, but it has to speak about the human condition and not just a particular, but a universal. So art uses symbol or metaphor. I think what is going on there, it uses the visible, whether in sound or visual form or words, it uses the visible to reveal the invisible. The universal condition of human being is at the level of the invisible. When Rothschild, at the end of that story, Rothschild's fiddle, Chekhov, plays that sound he heard from Jacob, and adds his own particular sense of the human condition to it. All who hear that sound, all who hear that music, want to hear it again and again and again, because it reveals something about the truth of the human condition. And no matter how successful you are, achieved, there's a level in which we know that, yes, this is our human condition. In the Russian folk tune, where through suffering, they connect with a deep reality. That's the perception that the artist holds on to. Or let me not say, I'm not sure the artist holds on to it, but he perceives it in some way. And he brings that out. The sorrow of a Russian caught in a Russian folk tune speaks deep to the heart of men. And that's the human condition, gotten through sound, something visible or audible.
Right.
But it's getting not just to the pattern itself, it's pointing beyond itself to the human reality, human condition. And when we hear it, it's so direct, it's so powerful. When we have ears to hear it, I'm going to have to qualify that, it moves us, it arrests us, you know, both. It stops us and outwardly and moves us inwardly.
And so just to recap for a minute here, so it would be fair to say that art is something that points us beyond itself, right? Yep. Art is something that points us beyond itself, and that it takes us from, when you're speaking of symbol or metaphor, the particular pushing us towards the universal. Yes. I'm thinking of being in second and third grade when I'm writing short stories and my teacher keeps telling me, show me, don't tell me, right? Yes. As opposed to this idea of like just literally giving word for word account. No, yes. You want to encapsulate something bigger, something grander. Yes. Through symbol.
Yes, and that's another characteristic of art. It involves, the artist is not intervening himself, herself, between the viewer and the work of art. The viewer is directly in contact with art. As I said, it's a perception. But what the artist captures is a particular combination, whether in the visible or the audible, or the words that are used in such a way that they're showing and not telling. And there must not, should not be anything interrupting that direct experience. So that we may speak about that. If the first is by humans, to humans, about humans, the humanistic core of art and its origin and destiny, so to speak, and it gets to the universal through the particular and therefore symbol. It has a unity. Nothing is, if it's done well, nothing is lacking to be added and nothing is missing. We use of a phrase, the beauty in a work of art, even though it may be about an ugly subject, is that it has a perfection, an objective perfection. It's to be kept pure, nothing added, and entire, nothing removed. So it has an objectivity to it in its unity. It's some artists, some writers and literary criticism, art criticism, speak about an objective correlative, where the emotions, perception is objectively represented in what is before us. I was reviewing the poem this morning, Art's Poem, Nietzsche's Ars Poetica, in a tradition of saying what art should be, in this case, a poem. And toward the end, for all the history of grief, the leaning grasses and two lights above the sea. And he adds, a poem should not mean, but be. So you're encountering being in a particular way through this, the artist knows how to. And now this brings up a kind of element about art. We don't want or need the poet coming in and telling us what it means. We've already limited by that said, you show, you don't tell. If you've done your work well, it's embodied in the work as it should be, and you get it from the work and not from the artist talking about the work. I may even add, the art critic may see in what the artist has produced more than what the artist intended or other than. So I don't need Shakespeare commenting to me on his poetry. He did the job well, it's in the work.
Right.
So the work communicates it to me. So there's a unity in it where it stands alone, doesn't stand in need of some outside, and there's a unity in it intrinsic, where all that should be there is there and nothing extra.
Okay. So in the artistic process, what you're suggesting is the artist may capture something that they themselves are not fully aware of or have not understood to its full depth.
Yeah, it's like you perceive it, you sense it, you pick it up. It's like the trunk of a tree. It's rooted in the ground and it comes out in the branches.
Right.
And artist transmits that. I don't mean the artist is just a kind of a seance.
Right, sure. You know?
But he has to perceive it, and often he comes to that perception by way of a certain kind of suffering. And so suffering connected with longing for the ideal, the perfect, and the absence of that resonates deep within the artist. And out of that comes that perception of this that he's longing for.
So as we're talking about this art being expression, and it's more than expression, right? We've also qualified it by saying it's by humans, for humans, right? And it's showing and not telling. You talked about how it oftentimes is connected to human nature.
Yes, that's the universal.
Yes, that it's universal. When I think about beauty, and then we talk about human nature, an aspect of at least the human condition is a state of brokenness. Yes. How can an artist beautifully portray brokenness? I think that's where a lot of people kind of say, well, no, art doesn't need to be beautiful, because sometimes it just kind of expresses our brokenness. It expresses some of the dark aspects of humanity.
Yes. Thinking about, I want to refer to it as a Shakun by Bach, connected with the feelings after the death of his wife and the notes that were played and how it came out. It's quite different from, let's say, some things in the Brandenburg Concerto, but it's beautiful in that it captures it. It says what we're feeling, it says it well. And that fit of the feeling invisible that is being revealed, the beauty is in that point. It's the way people shook their head after hearing Rothschild's fiddle at the end, and they sigh and they said, yes, that's what I'm feeling. So there's a beauty there. There's a beauty in rock and roll when the performer, let's say U2 group, I forgot the name of, not the singer, but the guitarist, he is able to make those music, and his whole body language is expressing something that we're feeling. We're happening to be feeling that which he's expressing, and there's a beauty in that. It moves us deeply. Now, we may not always be there at that stage of our lives with that feeling. Our feelings can change, develop, mature. So the power with which someone may experience something that expresses their feeling when they're 12 years old or 14 years old or 16 years old, maybe like the power one experiences when, after many years, the death of your spouse.
Right.
It deeply moves, but it doesn't mean that we stay with those emotions that we have when we're 14, 16, etc.
Right.
So we can account for a similar subjective state without reducing art to that pleasing sound.
Okay.
You're 14 or 18 or 48.
Right. Okay. So I have one more question for you, because we are coming to the end of our time here. And so, but before I do that, if you could recap for us, you've given us some of the, you know, these bullet points as far as what art is. Can you recap that for us? And then I have a follow-up question here.
If I were to recap it in this way, perhaps I might split the first point. Between art and non-art, it is by humans. And secondly, it's about humans, the human condition. And thirdly, it gets to the universal through the particular by way of symbol. And four, art has a unity, twofold. It stands alone in itself, it's complete, and has a unity. Nothing is to be added or taken away or changed. It has a unity and a satiety, so to speak. So those four points is by humans, it's about humans, it's about the universal condition through the particular symbol, and has a unity in itself in a number of ways.
Okay, thank you. That was very helpful. So along the way, you briefly mentioned the necessity of having ears to hear. And so I think that does raise this question as we're seeking to define art. One of the things that leads to the difficulty is that we do have aesthetic disagreement. And so as we consider art and what you've put forward here, why the aesthetic disagreement? What would it mean to have ears to hear in this context?
Let me suggest from that last example, a 14-year-old, assuming ordinary life, no death of close ones, he has to experience that longing for the ideal that, let's say, a 58-year-old or 68-year-old or a 78-year-old might experience at the death of his loved one. He doesn't have that experience. He's yet to have that experience. So they may hear it and it doesn't register, it doesn't connect for them as a 14-year-old or even as a 24-year-old. So we'd have differences there. And then even when we think about death as an adult and the loss of a loved one and what it is, what a person is and what death may mean, and whether death is simply natural like an animal or whether it's much more than that, that it's unnatural given what we are as human beings. Your ideas about what it is to be human and to encounter death could differ not just between the unexperienced and the mature person, but in terms of their worldview. The Taj Mahal was done by a Muslim emperor in India. They used Indian labor, which is exceptionally skilled. If you are up close to the Taj Mahal over 22 years. But death to an Indian in an Indian worldview is very different from death to a Muslim that believes in personal immortality rather than impersonal immortality in the reincarnation view. So those two worldviews can come out differently. One can build a Taj Mahal to do something that will hold us one's memory as immemorial, and another will let it go and ask you to let go of it as a condition of your enlightenment. So there are different worldviews
right.
that come out in such a well-known thing as a Taj Mahal. So there are ways in which you can understand and explain our differences in art. Now, when we come closer together, you don't have these differences. We have even more interesting discussion about the differences in art. But I think we can agree with it. Remember Mozart to Salieri, he was playing a tune. He said, should it go this way or is it this way? And he improves on it. And both will agree that was improvement.
Right.
There's objectivity in it.
Yeah.
That's the objective correlative. So I don't and won't yield to subjectivity in art. If anything, I'd want to go in the opposite direction and says, oh, it is so objective, you haven't begun to realize.
And I think that is a nice way of us wrapping up here, because it then creates this call that for the artist and those who are then partaking, observing, experiencing the art, right? There's something to work toward, right?
Yes.
There is something worth the question of how does it make me feel is a legitimate question, but it doesn't stop there. There's so much more we can think of and build off of when engaging true and beautiful art.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
I hope we will have more conversation.
Absolutely.
Take care. Bye-bye. All
right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Signature of Man podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, leave a review, and share it out on social media. You can also email any comments or questions to thesignatureofman@gmail.com.